This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. I'm your host, Aliza Arjan. Today, I'm joined by Regan Gillam, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Southern California. We'll be talking about her book, Visualizing Black Lives, Ownership and Control in Afro-Brazilian Media, recently published by the University of Illinois Press. So thank you very much, Regan, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Of course. And, you know, as some of our listeners might know, Regan is also a host at the New Books Network, and I personally enjoyed many of your episodes, so it's a, you know, special pleasure to have you as a guest today. And as you're familiar, we often start by getting to know our authors a little better, so I'll ask you to tell us a little bit about your background as an anthropologist and how you conceived of this book.
Yeah, thank you so much. I am a host on the New Books Network, and I'm delighted to be on the other side of the microphone talking about my book after talking with so many people about their wonderful books. So this book grew out of my dissertation from my research at Cornell University, where I was where I did my doctoral research. But I became interested in Blackness and racial dynamics in Latin America at the University of Virginia, where I did my undergraduate study. And I remember attending an event with an Afro-Colombian activist who came to tell us about Black social movements in Colombia. And that was where that event kind of opened my eyes to Black communities in Latin America and to, you know, social movements and activism there, and just to the conditions of Black people in different Latin American countries. And so that sparked my interest in that topic. I then took different classes at University of Virginia around race and ethnicity in Latin America, classes on, you know, on Brazil, on the African diaspora, and I just became really interested in Black people in various parts of the globe. I also, when I started then to do my PhD research, I went to grad school to study, you know, Black social movements, particularly in Brazil. And around 2005, when I kind of started to do the research, the TV da Gente television network was started, or Our TV. And this was a television network that was launched to with the idea, with the mission of representing Black people in Brazil. And so this was also a time when there were all of these debates in Brazil around affirmative action and different policies to include Afro-Brazilians into Brazilian institutions like higher education and in the educational curriculum. And so I decided to, you know, focus on these topics around social movements through media. And I began to study this question of how Afro-Brazilians represent themselves if they have autonomy over media production. And so the book includes work on this television network, but I've also expanded it to include short films, YouTube videos, and other images. And, you know, overall, I'm arguing that these media producers foment anti-racism by making their programs that center Blackness and, you know, telling Black stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly am glad that this path took you to this book. And, you know, I really want to delve into the ethnography in a little bit. But first, I want to set up some terminology that you use and the people you worked with use. So could you speak to what Black and Blackness mean in the context of Brazil? And how do your collaborators use it as they produce and circulate visual media?
Sure. This is such an important question. I use the term Black or Afro-Brazilian to refer to African descendant individuals and communities in Brazil. Brazil is said to have the largest African descendant population outside of Africa and receive the largest numbers of African people during the transatlantic slave trade. And so I don't use the term to refer to biological makeup or any kind of essential identity. The people with whom I spoke use the term negro or Black to refer to themselves and the work that they did. And then, of course, racial identity can be very complex in Latin America and in Brazil due to the idea of a middle category or a pardo category, which might also mean brown. Also, people can refer to themselves using different color terms in Brazil. And so there's not necessarily like a Black-white dichotomy. And so Brazil is known as a country that has privileged racial mixture, and in saying that everyone in Brazil is racially mixed, meaning, you know, everyone is a descendant of African, Portuguese, or indigenous descent, and therefore there is no color line and there are no racial categories. And this has been commonly referred to as a racial democracy or mestizagem or mestizaje. But as I said, I was interested in social movements and activism, and the Black movement in Brazil has used the term negro or Black to refer to people of African descent and, you know, to mark the particular kinds of inequality that people of African descent face, such as, you know, inequality in the labor market, access to education, low representation in government, lack of representation in the media. And so the people with whom I worked aligned with this approach. They used the term negro or Black to refer to people of African descent, and they were interested in creating representations that, you know, raise these issues around racial dynamics in Brazil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really helpful, and I really appreciate you clarifying what these terms mean in the specific context you're working with. And, you know, you gave us a sense of your focus on the visual, and I'm curious about what about the visual as a political tool towards anti-racism works in your book and in your collaborators' work? And why are the lenses of ownership and control useful in understanding the political importance of the visual?
Yeah, so the visual is, of course, really central to this project. And, of course, I look at media production and how it maintains and challenges racism or racial inequality. So researchers in Brazil have shown that, you know, the national media doesn't necessarily depict Afro-Brazilians in proportion to their size as a population, meaning that you'll see very few Black characters or actors in film and television. When these characters do appear, they tended to appear through stereotypical or limiting images such as maids or service workers or as other marginal categories. And racism was also rarely explored in the national media. And so the situation can be seen to naturalize the unequal position of Afro-Brazilians. And so the visual becomes really important in imagining different roles for Afro-Brazilians or in depicting them in different ways that acknowledge their complexity and their multiplicity, right? That in ways that don't flatten them into these like stereotypical kinds of representations. And then there were also in the side of like working in the media, there were few also Afro-Brazilians working in mainstream media. And so my book, you know, tries to focus on Black media producers. And I ask, you know, who controls the means of media representation? Who has access to create these images of Afro-Brazilians? And I talk about in the book how media producers many times recognize the disparity of Black people working in the media. They knew that this was not natural, but was rather socially constructed through inequality, meaning like access to education and who can then inhabit these roles of producing media. And so I argue that when the media producers, you know, insist on taking up these technologies of media representation, they're, you know, asserting their right to create representations or just to create media in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very helpful to know. And something I found really refreshing in the book was the perspective you bring to African diasporas through the visual. And you mentioned, for example, TV da Gente, where we see Afro-Brazilian media makers claim the means of media production through building relationships across the diaspora, reaching far beyond Brazil. So what can we learn about the diaspora by focusing on the work around accessing the means of media production?
Sure. The African diaspora is the idea that the movement of peoples from Africa to different parts of the globe through forces such as the transatlantic slave trade or, you know, or migration. So diaspora can be thought of as a condition where you can find people of African descent all over the world. But it's also a process in that it's the ongoing movement of ideas, people, you know, influences, connections between people of African descent across borders. So the TV da Gente, or Our TV television network, started with this mission to represent Afro-Brazilians. But also they had a mission to, in a way, to represent like the face of Brazil, meaning, you know, Brazil's multiplicity. So they also had Japanese Brazilians as presenters. There, you know, there, it wasn't fully just an all Black cast, if you will. But they did say that they did want to represent Blackness and Black people. And so the person who started it was named José de Paulo Neto, or he's commonly known as Netinho in Brazil. And he's a kind of an Afro-Brazilian celebrity. He was a singer, and he's also been on the host of different television programs. And so he got the idea for the network from the existence of Black entertainment television in the United States. And he didn't really want to replicate everything about BET or Black entertainment television. But it was just the existence of Black television networks in the United States that sparked the idea for him to do this in Brazil. And so he tried to reach out to BET executives to learn about running a Black network, but this wasn't really fruitful. It didn't really yield information for him because by then the network had been sold to, I believe it was the corporation. He did reach out then to the Black Family Channel, which was another Black television network in the United States at the time. And he managed to get television programs, which he translated into Portuguese and ran on the Our TV television in Brazil. And then they also used ideas for programming from U.S. shows. And so we can see how television programs can circulate through African diaspora networks, also ideas for programs, and then even just the possibility of the existence, you know, for such programs or for such networks. And so in some ways, these influences travel more easily than people physically many times. But the African diaspora, or these links across borders between people of African descent, is really important for struggles against racism and for representation, and that they kind of spark these ideas of possibility. You can look at other groups and say, oh, what are they doing? How are they struggling? Is that something that can work for us? And also just thinking about just different cultural and social influences that flow across these borders are really, you know, central for this work of representation.
Yeah, you put that so beautifully, Regan. And another intervention that you put so beautifully concerns irony. And in the book, you show us how irony becomes an animating force around the contradictions between everyday experiences of racism and the downplaying of racism. So could you speak more to what irony does for Black media producers in Brazil?
Sure. And this is my favorite chapter in the book. I believe it's chapter 3. And I loved doing this research and talking, like looking at these images and talking to the people. And I loved it, you know, for all the chapters, but this is one of my favorites. And so one of the ways that the media that I look at foment anti-racism is to depict racism. And so in Brazil, I mentioned that, you know, there are these ideas of racial democracy or particularly when I was doing the research that there is no color line. And so the existence of racism has also been downplayed or even denied. And so when people say, for example, the way that this can occur is people would say, you know, this event happened to me, this racist thing happened to me, I was turned away from, you know, I went to apply for this job, I was told that they had no openings, and then someone, you know, a white person maybe went after, and they were not told that, and they got the job, and I think this was racism, just as an example. And people, when you tell that to someone, they might say, oh, no, that wasn't racist. We don't have that here. You know, we don't have racism. And so, you know, there can really be this silence around racism or this, you know, denial of it. And where people just don't talk about it or they just didn't acknowledge it. So I looked at these different media productions that, you know, one thing they were doing was kind of representing racism with a kind of exactness. And these videos showed exactly kind of how racism works or operates, but they also did it through humor. And one of the things when I saw them, I instantly got the joke. I thought, oh my gosh, this is so funny. And I realized that everyone would not necessarily get that joke. It's very contextual. So you need to actually understand that the joke is on, you know, this denial of racism. And so, for example, I look at these videos called Tá Bom Pra Você, or Is That Okay With You? And it's a YouTube series produced by Erico Brás, Kenya Diaz, and their children, Gabriela and Mateus. And just as an example, they have a video where Erico plays a handyman. He comes to the apartment and he thinks that Kenya is the maid. And of course, this family they're all, you know, Afro-Brazilians. And Erico, he comes into the apartment. He's there to fix something, but he thinks she's the maid and he kind of starts to hit on her and, you know, assuming that she's the maid and her boss is away. And then, you know, and he thinks that she's a maid because as a Black woman, she's living in this expensive condo building. You know, he thinks, of course, that's the only position that she can occupy. But then the family comes home and the handyman sees that, you know, they're all Black and he realizes his mistake. And, you know, and so there's this humor in the video, but there's also this kind of irony in that in these videos where they show, you know, how racism operates in a society that denies racism. So in a way, they're saying, you know, if racism doesn't exist, then what is this that's happening to me? Why is this happening? And the humor, it turns the lens, you know, toward those who deny racism, kind of the joke is on them, those who would deny it, rather than, you know, the people who experience it. And so it's kind of absurd, you know, then becomes absurd to deny racism in the face of such depictions. And these videos really get at this experience of living this contradiction between experiencing racism as a Black person and then being told that it doesn't exist, right? So there's this constant, you know, contradiction of your, you know, of your kind of everyday life. And so the videos also get at this like frustration and anger and the absurdity of this situation, which can then kind of be encapsulated, you know, complexly in the laughter or the responses to the videos.
Yeah, this really makes me think back about the African diaspora, right? Like while reading that chapter and listening to your response just now, I was thinking about Turkey, where I work, and the denial of anti-Black racism versus the experiences of African migrants whom I worked with. So I think, you know, your focus on irony also shows how, you know, these contradictions go beyond national borders and is actually a diasporic issue as well. So I really appreciated that chapter. Yeah, but my favorite chapter was the one where you focus on Black filmmakers. And particularly, for example, you show us that Black film producers respond to the gaze on Black childhood in existing movies. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate on how your collaborators grapple with this gaze through film, or do they render film a medium through which they can speak back to fixed representations of Black childhood?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for this. And I'm glad to know that this chapter was a favorite. I really like this chapter as well, because of its focus on Black children, and these themes kind of emerged for me sort of later in kind of in the writing of the book. In that I noticed that I sort of went through and I was doing the research and interviewing the filmmakers about these films, and then I noticed sort of later that that children are commonly protagonists in many of these films by Afro-Brazilians. This wasn't something that instantly jumped out at me. And so I thought about, you know, why children, why this focus on children, and what is it doing? And one thing I noticed was that children, Black children, are rarely shown in mainstream media in general. So if there were few depictions of Afro-Brazilian adults, you see even fewer depictions of Black children. And you also see very few depictions of like Black families. So then you see very few children. And then if you take a film like City of God, it depicts Black children sort of as criminals. And they're mainly also Black boys. And many of the films by Afro-Brazilians, not exclusively, but you'll find a lot of Black girls in these films. So I also noted that many of these films, you know, take issue with what Black children are seeing or what they're looking at. So the films by Afro-Brazilians focus very much on this gaze of the children. And I try to use this idea of the oppositional gaze by bell hooks to talk about how the filmmakers, you know, present these depictions of Black children that, you know, counter these mainstream representations by trying to show the complexity of Black childhood and trying to show Black childhood as sort of a coming of age, and how Black children have to sort of come to terms with racism as they, you know, as they grow up. Like this is part of Black childhood. And so in the chapter, I was trying to take this layered approach in that the filmmakers put forward their own vision of how they would represent Black characters or Black children. And I look at, you know, three different films by three different Black filmmakers. And so these films take the approach that centers kind of, like I said, a racial politics to coming of age. And the films show the effects of Black children looking at a world that doesn't represent them. And they move to consciousness of their own experiences. And so one of the films, for example, was called Colors and Boots by Juliana Vincenzi. And she shows this Black girl named Joanna. And Joanna watches this television show called, you know, with this character of Xuxa, who was a famous children's show host in Brazil. She was a blonde, kind of, you know, light-eyed woman who would host these shows. And, you know, Joanna really aspires to be on television, yet you realize that Joanna, as a girl, as a Black girl who has, like, kind of wild curly hair. She will never, well, you know, the film presents the idea that she, that this is a barrier for her, and this is a world that she can't, you know, she can't join. And so we see in many of these films, we see the children kind of go from this, watching these films, and we see the effects of watching these kinds of representations. We see the effects of these representations on the children and on their consciousness, but then they move, to view themselves with pride and take a more positive, you know, view of themselves. And so these filmmakers, for these filmmakers, Black childhood includes this kind of coming to consciousness about race and racism and racial dynamics. And, you know, the gaze is really important here in that the children have to kind of pay attention to their own observations of the social world in developing this racial consciousness.
Yeah, for me, that chapter was just so powerful. But yeah, we've gone through your wonderful chapters. I want to zoom out a little bit to your broader argument. So again, you've alluded to this a little bit, but in the book, you developed the concept of anti-racist visual politics. So I'm wondering if you could tell us more about this concept and what kind of theoretical and political work does it do for Black lives in Brazil and beyond?
Yeah, thank you so much. So my idea of anti-racist visual politics ties together the book, and it's the idea that Black media producers break with, identify, and challenge racist practices, ideologies, and structures. And I try to use the work of Leith Mullings, who was an anthropologist, and I use her work on anti-racist anthropology to think about and develop this idea. And so it involves representing racism, asserting the right to control the means of production, and showing Black characters in more complex ways. And so I argue that this foments anti-racism in, you know, calling for and acknowledging, you know, the existence of the role of racism in Brazil, which I've talked about has been kind of silenced or denied. And I argue that it's really important to depict racism in its many manifestations, both structural and personal. And I talk about that in many of the different media that I look at, how they specifically talk about racism, and they talk about, you know, kind of structural racism as well as interpersonal racism, because of how racism has been denied or, you know, silenced in Brazil. And then I also talk about, you know, showing Black characters in more complex ways. And, you know, and again, I've already talked about how mainstream media tends to at the time depicted Black characters, you know, with these very limited kinds of representations. So in Afro-Brazilian media, you can find Black characters who are the protagonists of the story. And in making them the protagonists of the story, they're very central then to the narrative. We follow their own stories, their own narrative arcs. We hear their thought processes and how they're thinking about and negotiating these different challenges that emerge for them. And so in that way, we get these more, you know, complex characters that show a lot more multiplicity, as well as you in taking kind of all of the media that I look at as a whole, you can see these different kind of positions that Black people will occupy, such as like middle class professionals or, you know, children, like we just talked about. So they, you know, if you take it as a whole, you can see how there's a lot more, you know, complexity of social positions, of course, that Afro-Brazilians occupy in order to, you know, dislodge these very limiting roles that one can find in mainstream media. So, you know, I argue that, you know, all of this, like I said, I argue that it foments anti-racism and that it aligns with the goals of Black social movements in Brazil, which are to draw more attention to racism, to insist that Black people occupy different, you know, roles of power in Brazil. And so I, and to take part in these in this role of changing images of Blackness and Black people. And so I think that it does this political work, certainly for Black people in Brazil. And then I think in a way beyond, one might think about just the role that media plays in anti-racism. My cases are all from Brazil, but anti-racism has become a much discussed topic and concept in probably many different places, certainly in the United States, but in other certainly parts of the Americas. And one might think about how media, you know, challenge media aligns with the goals of anti-racism to represent, you know, Black people in or other minoritized communities in ways that maybe align with the political goals of social movements or activism or other kind of progressive currents going on in society.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate how, you know, you link the importance of media, not just for fomenting anti-racism, but also as something in intimate connection with social movements working towards that end. So thanks so much for making all these connections for us. And, you know, we are the Mobilities and Methods channel, so I want to ask you about your methodology that led you to this very important work. So I'm curious about what you used in your methodological toolkit to delve into Black visual politics.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It was really interesting trying to do this research, in that I had to kind of find the media that I was looking at. And it was actually very challenging to find this media that was, to a certain extent, it's all alternative media. To a certain extent, I wouldn't say necessarily underground, but it's not mainstream. And so, you know, having to then find media that is itself not circulated in mainstream avenues is itself a challenge. And so one of the ways I did that, I found it, was through my initial connections with people at the television network, which is where I started the research. And that was sort of the largest and probably most mainstream media that I look at. But then I moved on to these other, you know, filmmakers. And one of the ways I found them was through like different social media channels like Facebook, and actually mainly Facebook, and then also word of mouth, and seeing their films or some such thing featured in other websites. So it was all sort of working through these networks to find people. I also then, once I found the work, I would get in touch with the producers. And basically, I undertook semi-structured interviews with them. And I would ask them about their work producing this media, why they produced it, what kind of ideas led them to produce these particular narratives, what were they trying to say with this media. And so I did that with most of the media producers. And then I tried to think about how their media aligns with or doesn't align with kind of mainstream ideas about race in Brazil, as well as social movement ideals about race in Brazil, and think about the way that they're interfacing with these different ideas about race and blackness, and what ideas are then communicated by their media texts. And so I did these, like I said, I did these interviews with people, and then I also participated in the media production when and where I could. So that meant going to different sets with people and accompanying them as they produce the videos, as well as going to different video screenings that people had where they were sharing their videos with audiences. And then I would, you know, take notes, of course, at these different sites. So those were some of the methodologies that I used. And of course, as an anthropologist and an ethnographer, I'm also taking note of what's going on in Brazil at the time. So of course I did this research in Brazil, mainly in São Paulo, Brazil, but I have one case, the ironic videos that I mentioned are from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, but I was also tracking, you know, the different issues that were taking, that were becoming very salient in the public sphere around race and around racial dynamics. And as I said, at the time, it was affirmative action, which was the kind of policies to facilitate the entrance of Afro-Brazilians and indigenous people and, you know, other marginalized people into universities, as well as law 10.639, which was a law to teach Afro-Brazilian history and culture in schools. And I say that because many times the people that I was working with would mention these laws and these policies as well. So I had to then, you know what was going on within the political sphere. And so it was kind of putting together all of these different conversations and the media texts themselves, as well as the current events, to think about what the media that I was looking at was doing and how it was participating within these, within, like I said, fomenting anti-racism and within these different, this very sort of charged milieu that I was working in.
Yeah, and the very, you know, rich, multi-layered work you've done really reflects itself in the book. Another thing I was curious about was, so throughout the book, you guide us through what to see in Black media, you know, especially as you explain these movies, moving images or still images. So I was wondering if you saw this work as an extension of your collaborators' projects to control and own the gaze of your audience. And if not, how did you approach analyzing images with your collaborators' concerns and goals in mind?
That's an interesting question about the relationship between the goals of the collaborators and then and my own goals as a researcher. I think that with the collaborators, it was interesting because actually many of them would say that they were not activists, and you know, I don't know that they would say that they were participating in social movements. So there was that sort of difference, I guess, in the kinds of lenses that we would bring to the media. However, they would say that they were trying to produce new images of Blackness. They were very much in dialogue, if you will. They knew very much what was being represented in mainstream media and how they were in dialogue with that, whether they were trying to sometimes trying to replicate what was in mainstream media, sometimes trying to challenge it, other times trying to, you know, deviate away from it. So they all, you know, they were not necessarily all in one accord, and they had different kinds of ideas about how sort of Black people should be, you know, should be represented, and what these messages should entail. So, you know, it was a very diverse idea of, I think, goals and agendas that different people had. And so when I, you know, approach this with their concerns and goals in mind, I think I definitely would, you know, listen to them and try to hear their perspective. And I think in many ways I would, you know, align with them in that, you know, there does need to be more representations of Blackness on mainstream television. I think then what I bring to the to what it is they're doing is this analysis of anti-racism and of and then in trying to distill these different themes that I see across their media. Because another thing was they weren't necessarily in communication with each other, didn't necessarily see themselves as being part of a sphere, as I don't know that they would say they were producing quote unquote like Afro-Brazilian media. They might say, well, I have my own production company and I'm producing these kinds of films, but I don't know that they would see themselves, like I said, as a larger, you know, group of people. And so I think as well, I put what they're producing in dialogue with one another to then pull out these larger themes and ideas to find these kinds of connections across this media and to think about, you know, what it, like I said, how it aligns with the political situation.
Yeah, on a similar note, I'd also love to hear more about how you used images throughout the book. And as I ask that, I have in mind, you know, any images from the book cover to the photos sprinkled within the text. And was your usage informed by an anti-racist visual politics, or, you know, what concerns did you have in mind as you also replicated some images and visual politics?
Yeah. So yeah, thanks for that question. The cover was informed by these different images of graffiti that I had taken, and I gave these graffiti images to the press, and so they chose the graffiti images to kind of sprinkle across the book. The images on the cover are not my images. Those were the images that was made by the press, but informed, I think, by these different images that I took of graffiti. And so, I, like I said, I did the research in São Paulo, Brazil, and São Paulo is covered with graffiti all over the place. And so as I would move through the city, I would take these pictures of different, you know, just different graffiti. Sometimes it would be just a beautiful image that I found to be really pretty. Sometimes it might have some sort of political message. And so those were some of the images that I gave to the press. And then in the book as well, I have stills from, or kind of screenshots from, the different media that I'm looking at, as well as these graffiti images that I also took myself. So in the irony chapter that I mentioned, I look at this graffiti series of this particular Brazilian figure, and those images I took myself of this figure throughout in different scenes in São Paulo. But then the other images, like I said, were screen grabs from the different programs. And basically I was really just trying to give the reader a sense of what they could see in these different media productions, and really kind of demonstrate my argument of what I was trying to depict in words. I think sometimes the visual can speak quite powerfully. And so it's like, you know, there's like this irony of studying the visual, but, you know, but then having to render the visual through words and the textual, right? And so, you know, there's, I have this sort of back and forth between, no, but you have to see the image. So there are quite a few images in the book. And then also I wanted people to be able to then access the films as well, particularly those, if it's, you know, people who speak English, which of course the book is written in English. I wanted them to then be able to access the films, because many of the films are on YouTube. They have a subtitles, so you can actually watch them, because I think that the media that I'm looking at is very powerful, and it really depicts this other side of Brazil that many people would not get if they, you know, in most, like, even mainstream representations that circulate broadly. So I really kind of wanted to give people a look into these worlds and into the work that the producers are making, because I think that I think this work is very powerful. I think it's very, very moving, and like I said, it tends to be alternative. It doesn't circulate in the mainstream, but I think it could. So that was another goal of mine, is to really elevate the work that these producers are doing and let people see it and kind of lead them to it in order to kind of honor the work that they did.
Absolutely. It's so important. And for what it's worth, I looked up some of those movies after reading the book. So hopefully it will, you know, generate this kind of work that you intend the material to do. Before we end, I want to ask, what is next for you? What are some new projects or questions in which you're interested currently?
Yeah, so my next project is on the relationship between Afro-Brazilians in Brazil and African-Americans, or sort of people of African descent in the United States. And so I'm working on another book project where I'm looking at how Afro-Brazilians, like I said, in Brazil, mainly in São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, again, how they engage with and leverage cultural productions by African Americans. So just as an example, I look at how these two celebrities in Brazil, Thaís Araújo and Lázaro Ramos, they put on this play called The Mountaintop, which was a play produced by a African American playwright in the United States. And the play is about Martin Luther King. And I'm looking at how they put on this play and why. And one of the things they talk about was how they wanted the play about with focusing on Martin Luther King to address racism in Brazil. And I'm kind of unpacking that idea of how does a play about Martin Luther King address racism in Brazil? Why would Afro-Brazilians kind of pull from these US American, African American cultural productions to think about, you know, racism in Brazil? And I'm looking at how this challenges ideas of Brazilian racial exceptionalism, or the idea that Brazil, you know, does not have racism, or if it does have racism, the racism in Brazil is sort of less than or more cordial than racism found in other countries. And so I'm using these different cultural productions to think about these ideas about Brazilian racial exceptionalism and about the relationship between Afro-Brazilians and African-Americans and about the relationship between United States and Brazil. So it goes back to your question about the African diaspora and, you know, these circulations. I'm not done with that question. It's something that's really interested me. And then, of course, you can also hear these ideas about, like, performance and the visual as well coming out, you know, again. So that's the next project.
Well, I certainly will be looking forward to that book. And hopefully when it's done, we can have you again on the podcast. So thank you very much, Regan, for joining us and for your insights.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was really wonderful. And I thank you for all the work that you've been doing to bring people's work in anthropology and beyond to larger audiences.
I appreciate that. And thank you in return for doing the same kind of work for as long as you've done it. I'm your host, Aliza Arıcan. This discussion of visualizing Black lives, ownership and control in Afro-Brazilian media, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2022, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.